What are we filled with when we're full of ourselves? We're not filled with others. They have different interests. We're not filled with the world. And we're not filled with life. It's so much more unbounded. We're not filled with things that others are very interested in, as we discover when we can't stop talking about ourselves. Whatever we're filled with when we're full of ourselves, it doesn't seem to be very satisfying in the long term if the cries of loneliness and the yearnings for authenticity that we hear and feel around us are to be trusted. However you would describe the trap of being stuck only inside of ourselves, how do we get out of it? What's the path that leads out of self-absorption and into a more satisfying kind of life? These are among the ultimate questions of our day. We gather to pursue them in the hope and the belief that there may be something of value to be found and felt even here, even now. That is why we can say that it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. A place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together.
Yea, verily I say unto thee, this shall be known as the day of the Father, and upon this day and again in years hence, ye shall honor your Father above all others, and to show your reverence ye shall give unto him gifts of brightly colored cloth that he might tie around his neck, and yea, verily, gifts of scented water shall ye give unto your father, waters that shall be called by the name High Karate. The day of the Father, the establishments of eating shall be filled with those who honor their fathers.
And ye shall.
What is it, son?
You want to play catch?
Son, can't you see I'm busy here?
Doing what?
I'm trying to get a message across about honoring your father to these Unitarians. They need a little fire, a little brimstone. They're kind of wishy-washy, if you ask me. Need some direction.
Universalist.
What?
Unitarian Universalist. You said Unitarian. It's Unitarian Universalist. It's in the style manual. I looked it up in the church library.
Well, okay, whatever.
Plus, it's printed that way in the order of service and all church-sponsored publications, for that matter.
Look, son, I'm busy profiting here. Prophesying. Prophesizing. Making prophecies.
Okay, sorry.
So, as I was saying, the establishments of eating shall be filled...
Dad.
Shall be filled...
Dad.
What is it, son?
When will you be done?
I don't know when. But we'll get together then, son. You know we'll have a good time then. That reminds me of something. I just can't put my finger on it. Oh, yeah, that's it. I can just imagine.
I'm home.
Yay! Daddy's home.
How was your day?
Great.
Have you done your homework?
I did it the moment I came home from school. Would you like to check it for me?
Would I? Oh, let's look. Ooh, calculus, my favorite.
Mine, too. Math is fun.
I see you're having some problems with the use of imaginary numbers in your polynomial equation. Would you like me to spend some extra time tutoring you on this?
Would I? That would be super. I love you, Dad.
I love you too, my little acorn.
Son, it's time to do your chores.
Ow, what do I get to do now? Steal some cat food? Run around in some garbage? Wash my food?
All of them.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be great.
And I'm going to help you.
Oh, great, cool, yeah.
Because if I've said it once, I've said it 100 times. The family that raids together stays together.
Yeah, cool. You're like the best dad ever. Let's go knock something over.
Well, sometimes I just feel all awkward and clumsy and all legs.
Well, if it makes a difference, I felt that way when I was your age, too.
Really?
Yes, but if you just believe in yourself and have faith in the goddess, then someday you will blossom into the beautiful butterfly that you were always meant to be.
That makes me feel better about myself. Thanks, Dad.
Dad, can you read me a book?
Well, certainly. What would you like?
Go, Dog, Go.
Certainly. What an excellent choice.
And can you read it to me again, Kenya? Can you please?
But I haven't even read it the first time.
I just know it's going to be good.
Yes, my little furry friend. I will read it to you as many times as you'd like.
Thanks, Dad. I love you.
I love you too, son.
Okay. Wow. That was subtle.
No kidding. Now, see here. If you thought this was the part of the show where I suddenly have a change of heart and see the error of my ways, where I learn a valuable lesson about love and tolerance and the futility of ruling through fear and authority, the part of the show where we go off and live happily ever after in a rose-tinted world, a lovely little morality tale in 4 minutes, well, you've got another thing coming. I have business to attend to, prognostications to make, fire to hurl, brimstone to preach. People don't change, not like that. Not at the drop of a hat, not in the blink of an eye or the sound of a tune.
Really?
Really. Now, I have work to do. I'll see you when I'm finished. So you run along and play, and let your dad get back to business.
Okay.
Okay. Now, let's see. Oh, yeah. Yay, verily, upon this day, the markets that are super shall be filled with greeting cards that proclaim each father to be the greatest in all the land. And so honored will be your fathers, that the stores with departments shall lower the prices of their tube socks, so that your fathers might be showered with gifts of them. And upon this, the day of days for your father, he who is honored shall retreat unto his shop and tinker alone, until reflections of the meaning of this day fill his head, and he begins to remember. He remembers how he loves... No, that is... He remembers that a stern figure is the best example, that he... How his children make him feel like the luckiest dragon in... Wait! He thinks about authority. Stoicism. How his heart melts whenever he thinks of the depth of his love for his children. No, wait! Control! Distance! Oh, forget it. Son, wait! Come back! I'm sorry! I love you! I miss you! Come back!
Dad!
Son, I love you. I'm sorry. Puppets can change. I can change. The spirits did it all in one night.
What?
Nothing. That's a different script. Anyway, I was wrong. This is the part where I learned a valuable lesson about love and tolerance and the futility of ruling through fear and authority. The part of the show where we go off and live happily ever after.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son. You want to play catch?
Would I? Hey, I got you a Father's Day present.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, tube socks. They were on sale. Mom said you'd love them.
Cool.
Recent church fundraiser, I bid on an item and I won it. The right to name a sermon topic for Davidson. This could be fun, I thought. I picked humility. No, not because Davidson needed it, but because I needed it. We all needed it. In the last service, I illustrated the difference between being humbled and being humiliated when I missed a couple of cues. It was a practice run. Humility is a good topic for Father's Day. What more humbling experience can there be for those of us who are fathers than to be present for the births of our children? I want to tell you a story. Back in the 70s, this was a rather common sight. Cops beat up anti-war demonstrator. But this demonstrator was me. And this time, I was the one being choked. And it wasn't fun. I was arrested in a park across the street from the Travis County Courthouse. They called me a hippie. I called them pigs. I was angry before this humiliating experience, and I was angry after it. Not unlike most of my friends, I thought I had all the answers, and it felt good to reside in a safe university community and to have all the answers. I did not know the meaning of humility. I trusted few people over the age of 30. I burned my draft card, and I thought that anyone who went to fight in Vietnam rather than escape to Canada was a sellout. Fast forward 12 years to 1984. I was no longer an arrogant student. No, now I was an arrogant lawyer. And I had a very big case. Syndicated columnist Jack Anderson was writing about it. And there I was, former anti-war demonstrator in Washington, D.C., to take the depositions of two generals at the Pentagon, General Bernard Rogers, the commander of NATO and the highest-ranking United States general, and former Vietnam War commander, General George Patton III. My client was a major in the United States Army, a whistleblower, and a Vietnam veteran. As the two of us were riding in a cab, I nonchalantly suggested that we stop by the Vietnam Memorial. My client, a former helicopter pilot, was silent. Then he very quietly said, "No, you go. I'll wait in the cab." I said, "Okay." It was December. There was snow on the ground. I got out of the cab and walked quickly to get to the memorial. I planned to simply look at it and return to the cab. I remember seeing it come into view. There was one person on his knees with flowers. Then I saw the names. Thousands and thousands of names. And I was stopped, dead in my tracks. And in the cold wind, I began to wipe away warm tears that came from someplace deep inside of me. I stood there for a long time, and I felt some of that mean certainty of my younger days melt away like the snow. I walked back to the cab. I said nothing. My client said nothing. And as we rode silently back to our hotel, I felt somehow closer to the person next to me. I am still not clear on exactly what it was that happened to me that day. No, the memorial had not changed my view of that vile war, but it had somehow changed my view of myself. It had been for me a lens through which I could more clearly see my own youthful arrogance. I had been humbled. To my knowledge, I have not seen the police officer who arrested me for almost 30 years. I do know that whatever rage that was inside of him that day, there was an equal and opposite amount of rage inside of me. I also know that he was not a pig. He was a man. I would now ask that we turn to unison reading number 477. Forgive us that often we forgive ourselves so easily and others so hardly. Forgive us that we expect perfection from those to whom we show none. Forgive us for repelling people by the way we set a good example. Forgive us the folly of trying to improve a friend. Forbid that we should use our little idea of goodness as a spear to wound those who are different. Forbid that we should feel superior to others when we are only more shielded. And may we encourage the secret struggle of every person.
I spoke a few weeks ago about living under the gaze of eternity. I offer a prayer to those eyes in that gaze of eternity. They're the imaginary eyes of all the noblest people who've ever lived and all the best gods in the world's religions. They are the eyes under whose gaze we need to imagine ourselves living to lift us from our smaller possibilities into our larger ones. I would speak to those people and to those gods, and I would say, protect us from our exaggerated opinions of ourselves. Protect us from the arrogance that isolates us from others, the arrogance that isolates us even from our own greater possibilities. Help us find the honesty and courage to be humble. Help us to become small parts of a larger world rather than merely towering over a world scarcely any bigger than ourselves. Release us from the fears that bind us. Help us grow toward our true calling as children of God, sons and daughters of the universe, and the hope of the world. Amen.
You never know what you're going to be asked to do in these sermons that get auctioned off. And when I was asked to preach on humility, I thought, boy, that's a tough one. There aren't many ministers who could really do a good job on that. Most of them are too humble to begin with. And if you do a humble job on humility, it's just going to bore everyone to sleep. I thought, no, this really calls for something exceptional. You've got to have a lot of arrogance to preach on humility. It calls for a very special person, and that, of course, raised the musical question, but where in the world is there in the world a man so extraordinaire? And the answer naturally came immediately, c'est moi! C'est moi, I'm forced to admit, 'tis I humbly reply, that mortal who these marvels can do, c'est moi, 'tis I. I've never lost a battle or game, I'm simply the best by far. When swords are crossed, 'tis always the same, one blow and au revoir, c'est moi. C'est moi, so admirably fit, I am Prometheus unbound. And here I stand with valor untold, exceptionally brave, amazingly bold, to serve at the pulpit round. A preacher, you know, should always be invincible, succeed where a less fantastic man would fail. With a will and a self-restraint, that's the envy of every saint, he could easily work a miracle or two. No matter the pain, he ought to be unwinceable. Impossible deeds should be his daily fare. Oh, but where in the world is there in the world a man so extraordinaire? You know. Same what, I blush to disclose, I'm far too noble to lie. The man in whom these qualities bloom, same what, 'tis I. I've never strayed from all I believe, I'm blessed with an iron will. Had I been made the partner of Eve, we'd be in Eden still. C'est moi, the angels have chose to fight their battles below. And here I stand as pure as a prayer, incredibly clean, with virtue to spare. The godliest man I know, c'est moi! Don't encourage it. That song was not my idea, though it was my fault. When Derek first asked for a sermon on humility, my first crack was, oh, I can do a hell of a job on that. And after they thought about it, Donna called and I guess decided that if you can even be arrogant about humility, you ought to go all the way. I won't take the rap for being arrogant alone. I think we live in an arrogant age. So I want to talk about humility against the background of living in an arrogant age. You can find it everywhere. You go to the grocery store and look at the magazines in the checkout counter. And here are all the beautiful young people saying, you want to see what beauty, what elegance, what success, what desirability, what sexiness looks like? C'est moi. 20 years ago, People magazine began focusing on personalities rather than character or content. And it's interesting that now People, since it's just third person, plural, just isn't local enough to feel self-absorbed enough for us, so now we have magazines called Us and We that will bring it to the first person. We have in many liberal circles a movement called identity politics. I don't know how many have heard of it. It's kind of a narcissistic infection, I think. And it's infected a lot of circles within the Unitarian Universalist Association, I'm ashamed to say. To the point that minister days next week at General Assembly are spending the entire day on identity politics. Identity politics is the narcissistic habit of identifying people only by their differences from other people rather than by their similarities to them. Shining spotlights on groups of people defined by their differences one at a time, as though the whole game were to take turns singing, c'est moi, in a religion where no one has learned the word for us or we or community or even humility. I have ranted before about the stock market, but I see the stock market, when you define an economy as being healthy when it rewards only the owners, rather than asking, is it an economy where regular working people can afford to buy a good home based on one salary and can afford to send their kids to good colleges? When you define it only as an economy defined by the owners, this is a c'est moi economy where the privileged are singing c'est moi at the expense of the rest. Of the five times in the 225-year history of our country when the economy has tilted toward the wealthy and against the middle and lower classes, this is the most severe of the five times. The disparity between rich and poor is greater now than it has ever been in our history, and it's on the verge of getting monumentally worse. If the inheritance taxes are canceled, as they may well be, that will take probably $1 trillion out of the economy in the next decade. You can add that to the $500 billion budget deficit that's been approved by Congress. That means that there's $1.5 trillion that cannot and will not be available for Social Security, for health, for retirement, for workers' benefits, for any of the social nets that have kept us somewhere near a fair playing field in the past. It's looking out for number one. It's thinking that our proper place in life and our proper ambition is to be sitting on top of the world. You've heard this as much as I have. It's really an amazing notion that where we belong is sitting on top of the world. I flew over the top of the world this February and looked out the window. It's frozen solid. Nobody can live there. There's no warmth, no humans, no community. It's a ridiculous place to want to be. The human aspirations have always been to try to figure out how to live in the world and to do it with character, compassion, and warmth. My other rant, and I'll say what I've been saying since last September, I think our war is contrived. I don't think it's about terrorism. I think it's using the convenient excuse of terrorism as a cover for a war that's about oil, that's about imperialistic control of other countries, and about a country whose economic and military policies are working to turn the world into a two-tier economy of the very rich and the very desperate, and are now using our soldiers to fight this. As a Vietnam veteran who gave my heart to a bad war, I resent it. These are not the actions of a noble country acting nobly. They're the actions of a country concerned with its own interests narrowly conceived. A country that's singing C'est moi to a world that knows better, as the newspapers of the world say clearly every day. So this great Lerner and Lowe song, C'est moi, wasn't just sung in Camelot in the early 1960s. In many ways, it's become the theme song of our times. It's too small. And it makes us too small. I learned something a few years ago about koi, those decorative carp that the Japanese have breeded for centuries. And just recently, I read that the same thing is also true of crocodiles. And what seems to be true of these two animals is that they will only grow to fit the size of the pond that they're living in. If you put them in a small pond, they'll always stay small. In a medium-sized pond, they'll grow to medium size, and they can only grow to their full size in the largest pond around. That same is true of us. And the message of every religion I know of, at its best, has always been that being smug, self-absorbed, and arrogant makes it impossible for us to grow to our full size either. I spoke 2 weeks ago of the Danish existentialist Soren Kierkegaard, who lived in the early part of the 19th century, and of the Danish playwright Henrik Ibsen, who turned some of Kierkegaard's insights into dramatic scenes and plays. I talked a little about the play Peer Gynt, and I want to go back to it for one more illustration. Peer Gynt is really a play about the difference between authentic and inauthentic people. That's the subject. Ibsen dealt with it through wild symbolic characters, and he used trolls to represent inauthentic people. So it's a play about the difference between trolls and humans. And trolls and humans live by two different mottos. The motto of trolls is "to thyself be sufficient." The motto of humans is "to thyself be true." "To thyself be sufficient" is looking out for number one, trying to be on top of the world, being the man, and singing "C'est moi," when moi is defined too small to do justice to all we're called to become. The motto of humans, "to thyself be true," is a lot harder. And a lot bigger. It means being true to our greatest calling, being true to the most we should be and nothing less. To do that, our world has to be a lot bigger. So
so that we can grow to our full size, because like the koi and the crocodiles, we can't grow much bigger than the world of which we think ourselves a part. But how do you do it? How do you become most fully human and authentic? How do we outgrow the smallness that we slide into so easily and so often? The door that leads to outgrowing a small past, I think, has always been the door of humility or honesty. To acknowledge that we were wrong, we were smug, we were small, that the world is much bigger than we had imagined, that it would have been amazingly lucky for us if we'd been right in our simple certainties. I think of arrogance as a soul that has collapsed in on itself. Arrogance is the sound of people growing smaller while shouting, "C'est moi." It usually takes a powerful shock to our ego to get our attention and wake us up, especially when we become comfortable being a big fish in a small pond. In religious language, we call this an epiphany or a revelation or even a conversion experience. In real life, it's usually dramatic and it's always memorable. We never forget those moments in which we were rudely awakened from small certainties into a world of larger possibilities. That was what Derek's 4-minute confession was about. That's what happened to him at the Vietnam Memorial. I think it has happened to many, many people at the Vietnam Memorial. The time I visited, I stood there and cried for 10 or 15 minutes and wasn't even aware that I was crying. You're immersed underground in something big and dark and awful that was so seductive for so long. I don't want to go into more examples and more details on this experience. I want to trust that you've all had it, that you know these experiences that smack you in the face with a humility you didn't want and that isn't comfortable, and that you look back on later as a turning point in your life. We've all had them, large or small. So instead, I'll use this, since it's my last regular sermon with you for 2 months, to segue back to finish the sermon of 2 weeks ago when I had been talking about liberal theology. I didn't quite finish it last time, and humility is a perfect pivot to finish that too, because like people, religions can only grow when they can finally find some humility instead of arrogance. 2 weeks ago, I ended talking about Paul Tillich. I still think he was the best Christian theologian of the 20th century for a lot of reasons, partly because he was so frank about theology being closely related to depth psychology, something he learned from Kierkegaard, as so many of us did. But it was also that Tillich was so honest. He wanted every conceivable rude question to be brought to religion. He didn't want it protected from anything. He felt that a religion that couldn't stand up to honest questioning wasn't a religion worth honest devotion. Throughout his career, those who knew him, and a lot of us who read him, and I read a lot of him, felt that he was torn between two allegiances. It was the frustrating thing about this very great thinker. One was his desire to follow his insights to their logical conclusions, which would have led him beyond Christianity and beyond theism. He may have been the only religious thinker of the time with a mind powerful enough to have done this. So a lot of us wish that he had done so. But his other allegiance was to the Christian tradition. He felt that he was one of its ablest defenders and felt compelled to defend it in a time when it was being attacked by so much skepticism. But in his last 2 years of his life, from 1963 to 1965, he went to the University of Chicago, where he had a chance to meet and talk with another very great thinker, a man named Mircea Eliade, who was a profound scholar of world religions rather than Christianity. And when these two great men met, it was the younger man, Eliade, who changed the older man and gave him the chance finally to grow beyond both Christianity and theism. In a paper delivered only 12 days before he died, Paul Tillich finally acknowledged the step that he could have taken decades earlier and that could have changed the face of religion in America, perhaps, decades earlier. After learning more about the way human questions, the same human questions, are pursued in all the world's religion and all the world's mythologies, Tillich said that if he had it to do over again, he would not have written his theology from within Christianity. He would have written it instead from within a center of world religions. Even theologians who know Tillich's work don't seem to understand or want to discuss what this meant, but it was revolutionary. What he was saying 37 years ago was that, look, folks, it's obvious that all the gods and all the religions were created by the people who later came to worship them. But they were created as sincere, if local and transient, vehicles for the deepest human questions we've ever known. So the logical conclusion of liberal theology and the legitimate heir to the gods would come when we can take the step of owning our questions and pursuing the wisdom wherever it can be found, knowing that what hangs in the balance is the quality of this life, here and now. This is the secret, Tillich would say, and Eliade would say, that have been hidden within all the world's religions throughout all of history, waiting for people to unpack the symbolism and the myths and the metaphors and find it. At their best, the gods can be our resources and our teachers, though they began as the projected personifications of some of our highest hopes and our most sacred values, along with lesser things. In some ways, this has been the message of liberal theology from the start. 2 weeks ago, I talked about Origen, a great third century Christian thinker. He taught that religious writings always have to be taken symbolically, because if you take them literally, they're not religious. They're idolatrous. He also said that we need two things from religion. And I still don't know how to improve on this. He said that we are looking for those things that are useful to us and worthy of God. Those things that are useful to us and worthy of the highest ideals and values that we know how to say. Today, when we can learn about so many religions and so many mythologies, we have a whole range of gods to learn from and a whole range of religions. If we're smart, we're still looking for what's useful to us and worthy of the highest values, worthy of the gods. We come to church because we need a community of people who will be serious about life's serious questions. A place where we can try to establish an absolute relationship to absolute things and a relative relationship to relative things, and a place where we can try to find the wisdom to tell the difference between them. It's so hard to do. It's almost impossible to do alone. That's why we come to find a church community. What is it that's hard to do alone? It's hard to grow into the kind of life that's useful to us and worthy of the highest. Now, as you can hear, this opens up the whole field of religion to an infinite horizon. All religions, all mythologies, all great poetry, literature, drama, comedies, biographies, all of it is fair game to look for how to take ourselves and life more profoundly. That's a good thing. It will give us a lot to talk about when I resume regular sermons here in 2 months. But you know, someday, we're going to hear some important questions that we need to know how to answer. There'll be questions about a person who really did it. There'll be questions about a person who really lived the way we want to live. Someone who tried the best they could to be the best they could. Someone who had moral courage, strength of character, whose life was a blessing to themselves and to others. Someone who was authentic, who was true to themselves in the best way. Someone who really did it. And then a voice from somewhere will ask, "Do you know that person? Do you know them?" And more than anything, we want to be able to say, "Yes, God, yes, of course I know that person. C'est moi."